Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
Van Halen, and Ain't Talking About Love from their debut studio album called Van Halen. And that was released on the 10th of Feb, 1978 on the Warner Brothers label. And it was also released as their third single from the album later in the year in October.
Well, you know, yes, I've got this on vinyl as well. Eddie Van Halen. When I heard this record, it just blew me socks off because, of course, we were in the middle of punk and new wave, and like 78, yep. You know, so 76, 77. And all of a sudden, I heard this monster player, and I thought, what is that sound? His guitar, it's grinding, it's beautiful, it's magnificent, strident, powerful, all the things that, you know, it really took rock and roll guitar to a completely different place and level, really.
Yeah.
And it was like, it was sort of like Richie Blackmore on acid and a lot of other stuff. And, you know, that phaser, I think he's using a small stone phaser. I'm probably going to get shot down here, but I think it is. It's an electronic small stone phaser. On like, and, you know, absolutely remarkable. And, of course, as well, he had his amp set, his Marshalls, he used what is known as a brown sound, and everyone was trying to get this sound. And what he did, he actually reduced the voltage going to the amp. So he had a variac which had reduced the actual input voltage to the amp. So rather than running them at, in the States, it's 115 volts, of course, he ran them about 90-odd volts. And it gives a different sound. It gives a brown sound. Everybody was trying to find out what he was doing, including me. And eventually we found out, of course, before the internet, you know, so you had to read up and, you know, ring people up and say, what's going on with this dude? And funnily enough, Peter van Weelden in Appledon, who's an amp manufacturer.
In the Netherlands.
And we own one of his amplifiers. One of the finest examples of a Dumble sort of clone thing. It's my favourite one anyway. And he actually repaired and worked on Eddie Van Halen's amp. This very amp that this track was done by.
I remember, because when we went to see him.
Correct.
We saw his photo on the wall.
Indeed.
And we started talking about it. That's weird. You've got a really good memory, by the way.
Well,
but then
yeah.
You are a bit of a guitar head, aren't
but
you?
When it comes to amps.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And Peter, you know, and, you know, and very soon we're going to be moving to Europe, so... next few weeks, so it's going to be really cool. We're going to be seeing a lot more of him, I think. He's going to have a load of amps to look at, I know that.
But you know when someone, you know, because we were talking about this when we were in Spain about the different amp voltage and how we have to run our amps at a certain frequency to make sure that they don't brown out. Now, does that reduce the life of a tube if you... playing a tube amp?
Well, I don't think it actually does them much good.
No.
Because they're not supposed to be running at that voltage. But
no.
I'm not sure that it does them a lot of harm either, under voltage, you know?
No.
But over's
like
worse.
Underpants, under voltage.
Yes, indeed. Well, when we were in Spain, we used to run the studio at 240 volts.
We
and
did.
We had, we had a big power generator thing, a converter. What do you call them? UPS. And which gave a pure sine wave, which you've got to have for a valve
and
amp.
And even when we gigged, we have a portable one as well.
We did indeed, because Spain, the voltage is up and down like a bride's nightie. And I could hear my amp sort of browning out.
And I
didn't particularly like the sound of it. So what did we actually add a little...
just so you know, so we do care very much,
yeah,
so.
When
we rock up at gigs and we have the proper amps and, you know, my obviously my high watt's like 35 kilograms. I can't physically lift it up onto the top of my speakers. But anyway, my cab, but it's we do care.
Yeah,
that's the main thing. Because if your sound's not right, though, you're like a restless doggy in a basket. You can't play right.
Absolutely.
Your sound's not there, and it doesn't feel right.
Well, Eddie Van Halen went to a lot of trouble to get his sound sounding
I like
that.
Him, by the way.
Oh, absolutely monster. And Ted Templeman, who produced this record, I mean, he produced the Doobie Brothers. And prior to this, he produced Montrose, which is... Because Ronnie Montrose, he was a bit of a guitar monster as well, and Sammy Hagar on vocals, who eventually ended up singing with Eddie Van Halen, you know, and recorded at Sunset Sound. But there's one thing I don't like, and that's the drum sound, the kick drums. It's awful. It's an awful... It sounds like a pop. It sounds like somebody's hitting a bit of a box with a soggy sock. I'm in the mood to tear it up. Just can't tear it up enough. Don't want no full-time love. Baby, let me be. I need a whole lot of part-time love to satisfy me. Don't want no hand-me-downs. Got the best rags on my back. I don't need no used car. To tear it up. I ain't lying, I'm gonna tear it up. I'd be tearing.
can't tear it up and no. To tear it up.
Can't Tear It Up Enough, the opening track from their fourth studio album, T-Bird Rhythm, by Texas-based blues rock band The Fabulous Thunderbirds, released on 11th of January 1982 on Chrysalis Records.
The Fabulous Thunderbirds, but it's all about Kim Wilson, really, isn't it?
No.
No?
No, it's about Jimmy Vaughan.
Then?
Of course, Jimmy Vaughan. The guitar. Well, it's about Kim Wilson. Actually, you're right. I'm just having a.
But at the beginning, it was actually Jimmy and Kim.
It was, yeah. And Kim Wilson. I mean, he's got a fantastic voice, great harmonica player. But Jimmy Vaughan, of course, the brother of Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Yeah.
Marvelous guitar player, marvelous rhythm guitar player. And this lineup of the band, as soon as I heard this, and my old mucker Tim Wright, he played it to me, he said, "You've got to listen to this band." And I went, "Wow, this is incredible." And I remember putting it on and it jumped out the speakers and I was boogieing around like a monster.
Wow.
And then I went to see him at the Hacienda in Manchester.
You did not.
We did indeed. I went with Tim, and I think the rest of the band, we all went and ogled them, you know. But
what were they like?
Fantastic. They're absolutely, really, really good. It was a sweaty, dirty Texas blues gig. Great. And Jimmy Vaughan, he plays real clean, Strat mostly, and just remarkable. I think he had a couple of Fender Super Amps. I think he probably rented them in for the tour, you know. So, they were great, absolutely brilliant. And I think that they redefined the sound of Texas blues, really, because they kicked it off. Because you always think about Texas blues rock and you think it's ZZ Top.
That's true.
And it's a different thing, you know, and this is a lot swingier, a lot more sort of, it's clean, the whole sound is cleaner, but a tremendous groove. And the whole album is just fantastic, you know. I have it a lot.
I think that's brilliant. You've been to see them, you know, because there's one thing to listen to their songs, but to actually be in the room with them, that's what I love. Really, I love the both thing. I love the recorded format. You know, we love vinyl, but I'm looking at you in bewilderment, really, because you've seen so many of these beautiful bands and stuff.
Yeah.
And the reason why I mentioned Kim, because I know about Jimmy Vaughan. But with Kim Wilson, I was just reading now that he was like mentored by Muddy Waters.
Mm.
And it's just like, this is why I was just looking and they were like the house band at Anton's in Austin, Texas. And they basically supported all the traveling musicians that came through. And so, I mean, what an absolute fantastic opportunity.
Mm.
I think he had passion because I think he took up the harmonica later in school. So he wasn't actually, he didn't stop from a really, really young age, but he just progressed really rapidly. So he's, but what a, I'm actually quite excited because But I think with these guys, I think I'd prefer to feel the music in physically live.
Well, I think there's no doubt that Keith Ferguson and Frank Christina, the rhythm section,
yeah,
I mean, they also added a tremendous amount of dynamic. And this is by far the best incarnation of the band. Yeah, wow. Yeah. But you know the reason why this record sounds so good?
Yeah.
Nick Lowe produced it.
Get out of here.
No, absolutely. And it sounds like it jumps out the speakers.
How did you find that out? Because I've done the research and it was very difficult. It was very scant information available.
Indeed. Well, I know these things because I remember looking it up.
Right, okay. Yeah. And Nick Lowe.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, he's a monster. And also, I think he brought a very British thing to it.
It
actually sounds very live, you know, and it's got a, it's very open sound and there's a lot of live room in it. You can hear it. And it just sounds like they just rocked up and did it. And I suspect they did. That sounded like it was done in a couple of takes, you know, with just that overdub. That great solo in the middle with that tremolo, that real fierce, deep tremolo. Gorgeous.
When I was a little girl, I had a rag doll, only doll I've ever owned. Now I love you just the way I love that rag doll, but only now my love has grown, and it gets
Ike and Tina Turner and River Deep, Mountain High, released as a single in May 1966 on Phil's Record label, which is basically Phil Spector's record label.
Written by Phil Spector.
Jeff Barry.
Yeah, and Ellie Greenwich, or Greenwich.
Greenwich.
Because, exactly. Of course, the Americans are probably saying
exactly.
Greenwich. It's, of course, Greenwich.
Greenwich, yeah.
Phil Spector, well, you know, he considered this his greatest work. And when you listen to it, the wash of reverb, the whole band and orchestra sound like they're in a huge reverb tank, which basically what he, you know, when he was doing the Beatles sessions later on after George Martin sort of threw the towel in and all that hoo-ha with John Lennon went on and the way he wanted Phil Spector. You know, he was always screaming, literally, more reverb, that's all he wanted, more reverb. And on this, he certainly got it. But it's a complete classic sound, I mean, you know. But, there's no power to it because it's like massive, but it's not powerful, if you know what I mean, because it's so back, because it's drenched in reverb. But, I mean, well, it's an amazing production, and it, you know, and the vocal performance and the song, I mean, wow.
It's a bit incredible when you read about what he did, because he had this wall of sound. So he, excuse me, it cost an unheard of at the time $22,000 to record, because he had 21 session musicians and 21 backing vocalists, right, background vocalists, and they recorded at Gold Star Studios in LA, and the Wrecking Crew were playing on it.
Yeah.
Glenn Campbell was on guitar. I love this. Hal Blaine on drums.
Wow.
Liam Russell on keyboards. Earl Palmer on drums. And Carole Kaye, kick-ass, on bass. So you've just got this amazing, I mean, it's world-class. It's the best you can get. And when actually Phil wanted to work with Ike and Tina, he knew that Ike was quite controlling in the studio. So he had this amazing, like, unusual contract drawn up, which is basically that the album and the singles were going to be co-written, attributed to Ike and Tina.
Mm.
And he paid Ike Turner an extra $20,000 to stay away from the studio.
No.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So we got Tina in, and he made her sing it over and over and over and over and over, literally. And she's quoted as saying that she must have sung it like 500,000 times. And she got that. She was that hot. It sounds a bit odd, but she basically got down to her underwear because she was literally just singing it and singing it and singing it until he was happy with the take. And I know that, well, I don't know Phil Spector anyway. So that I've never heard of somebody like, when she said 500,000 times, you just kind of go, well, that's intense. So anyway, so you've got this Phil Spector going, right, okay, I really love you, really want to record, know that Ike's controlling, right, he can do that, respect you both, but let's get the best, here's the wall of sound. And then they released it, and it only reached number 88 in the Billboard 100 charts.
No.
Yeah. And number 3 in the UK. So it was bigger in the UK than it was in America, and that was the beginning of Phil Spector's disillusionment with the recording industry, and he basically became a recluse.
Wow, and I didn't know that. I thought it was a monster hit.
No, he was just really, really sad about it. So he basically was just so fed up with the disillusion, basically. So, and that was really the start, I think, of his self-destruction.
Wow.
It says that they kind of, he only returned to the studio sort of intermittently after that. And the thing is as well, that they were going to, Ike Turner felt that the record didn't do too well in America because the sound was pop or white, whereas Tina was more R&B and it kind of a mixed race feel. Anyway, they were just, I think this is another reason why, and I love this. I've just, as you carry on, when you read, you go, well, why is that? Like you just said, right? So although earlier records, which had mixed black singers with a white pop sound, had sold well, it's the time, because by 1966, the black political movement was encouraging African-Americans to take pride in their own culture, and River Deep Mountain High was out of step with that movement.
Thank you.
across the evening sky. All the birds are leaving, but how can they know? It's time for them to go. Deserted shore, your fickle friends are leaving. Oh, but then you know it's time for them to go. But I shall. Of time, well, who knows where the time goes? Who knows where the time goes? And I am not alone. Where the time
Sandy Denny, Who Knows Where the Time Goes. This version was from a BBC session with John Peel in September 1973. Written, of course, by Sandy Denny. She originally recorded the song as a demo in 1967.
I really like her. And the thing is, I don't really know Sandy Denny very much at all.
But you were a folkie.
I know,
thought
but
you'd really be into it.
No, I hadn't. And the thing is that it just felt like home listening to her. So, it's so intimate. And you can hear, you know, she made me smile because of the way she was pronouncing her words. And it just felt so alive. And I was in the room with her then. I was just closing my eyes. I love that version.
Mm. Well, it is. I think it's the best one. And just looking, because it doesn't say who the musicians are on that track.
Right.
But by looking about what she was doing at that time and the album that she recorded later on, I think that's Richard Thompson on guitar.
Really? No. Mm.
That tremolo guitar, I think that's Richard Thompson. And I think the acoustic guitar is her soon-to-be husband at that time, Trevor Lucas.
Wow.
And of course, later on, she joined Fairport Convention, and the album after, Gene Russell was on it, Dave Pegg,
Peggy,
Danny Thompson on bass, Dave Mattox on drums, and all those guys, you know, because we've met them. Well, I've met them quite a few times on the Isle of Man, because they often come over Fairport Convention, or they have done.
Yeah.
And I sat in the White House with Dave Pegg, you know, chewing the fat, as they say.
Well, do you know, one of my ambitions is to play Cropperty.
Is that right?
Yeah, I'd love to, because, I mean, I've seen the Buzzcocks at Cropperty. It's not a folk. It's not just all about folk. I've seen, I saw Stevie Winwood, Cat Stevens, who's now Yusuf.
Islam, yeah.
He was headlining on the Saturday night. I got to hear Ralph McTell.
Wow.
Streets of London.
Yeah, well, that's
And Nick Kershaw.
No.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be good if we...
I know, but for me, it was like, I won't let the sun go down on me.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I was like, stood there going, this is just really weird.
Oh, baby, you're an 80s girl.
I know. Well, I was into disco, soul funk disco,
of course.
Even though you tell me that. But I love dancing, that's the thing. But so Cropperty, to me, is not just a folky thing. It's a place for people who love music and love to hang out. And I know there's loads of people with chairs and you have, but it's like this whole field goes uphill, so you can sit and see all the way down, so you can have flags. You just have loads of flags everywhere, so you know where to get back to.
Yeah.
The food's fantastic. The crowd's fantastic. Okay, there's lots of people with beards, but there's lots of fairy rings. You know, I mean, it really is. It's a most inspirational and an intimate festival. And I want to play it, basically, at some point.
Well, I think it's on the list.
But we play acoustic as well. So we can do, and I saw Aid Edmondson and the Bad Shepherds there as well.
Right, okay.
He was playing that year. So, I mean, the thing is, music's music. And I have actually written to Peggy because we're connected on Facebook. So I was just saying, you know, I won't come play.
Well, it's definitely a cool festival.
Anyway, going back to Sandy Denny, if you don't mind.
Well, not at all, because Sandy Denny, of course, the first time I ever heard her was on the Battle of Evermore by Led Zeppelin, because she actually sang on that. And I didn't know who it was, and she has that gorgeous voice. And that duet she does with Robert Plant is just absolutely sensational. And that's the first time I sort of came across her. And then, you know, later on, when I was listening, I sort of heard Fairport Convention, and she joined the Strobes briefly, of course.
Yeah, she did before she joined Fairport.
Yeah, and of course, our mate, Dave Bainbridge, is now playing keyboards with the Strobes.
Exactly. It's just it's a family, isn't it?
It is, yeah, you know. And you know, I feel so privileged. I've never in the centre of it. But I've always been, you know, touching on the outskirts and just going deeply in and then out again. It's like the sea washing against your feet, you know.
Everyone's like that, though. Because you can't always be centre of attention or always on tour all the time, unless you're like B.B. King or Kim Wilson, you know, on tour all the time. So it is a peak and a trough kind of thing, an ebb and a flow, and I really like that. But what I didn't realise as well is Sandy Denny, and I really love her, you know. Just listening to that song now, I really just have this connection with her. But Judy Collins heard her demo before she'd actually recorded it properly, as okay. in released it herself. So Judy Collins was the first to record that song.
Is that right?
To release it. Yeah. So commercially, it was first available with Judy Collins, but it didn't matter because it's Sandy Denny's just outright slam dunk, got in there. Loads of people have covered it. And what I also love, you know, talking about like we know Dave and we know people because we're music family, that's what we are. When Sandy Denny first started playing music, she was trained to be a nurse and she was encouraged to by a couple of guys that she met who were struggling artists at the time to carry on, and it was Simon and Garfunkel.
C'est certain, j'ai très très peur, mais beaucoup moins que tous les gens à cette taille. De mon bateau en très profond, naviguer une direction.
You're listening to The Supertones Show with Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
That was Stereolab and Percolator, the third track from their fourth studio album, which is fantastically named Emperor Tomato Ketchup. I love that so much. And that was released on the 18th of March in 1996 in the UK by Duophonic Records, and a few weeks later on the 9th of April in 96 in the USA by Elektra.
Well, I love that. When it came out, and I can't remember where I heard this first. I just rushed out, literally, and bought, because I'm afraid, vinyl again. And it just sounded so different and so great. And it was like, post, I don't know, post electronic. I don't, it had all those analog synths in and all that. What I loved about it was that in the middle is, and I love a vocal. It's a very jaunty, that French thing, you know, very, very sexy vocal. I think it's lovely, you know, and a really cool groove and very unusual, you know. Yeah. It just jumped out at me. I thought, wow, I love that.
It translates as well because you've got the instrumentation and then you've got the, as you say, it's a beautiful, sexy... And so you have that kind of swagger and that sway and it kind of, I don't know, it affects the way you walk almost, you know, because you kind of feel uplifted by it and it feels like you've just had a fantastic croissant or some or a great experience, you know, like a really good like breakfast or a brunch thing. I don't know, it just feels fresh and, you know, I think it just makes you feel good, feel alive and feel, and when you actually, like you say, you've got, I actually really liked it. It's like, yeah, there was something fresh about it. And I think it makes you just feel like you've had a new experience.
Yeah. And it was recorded, interestingly, at Black Wing Studios in London, where a lot of Depeche Mode stuff was done. And
no
Yazoo,
way.
Yeah. Cocteau Twins, Dead Can't Dance on 4AD, our mate Ed Horrocks, of course, who runs that label.
Yeah, yeah.
My Bloody Valentine. Pixies, you know, and lots of people and a couple of albums by Stereolab. So, you know, and they were really into that electronic thing, obviously, you know, apart from the Pixies. I mean, they're quite different. But.
Do you know where they got the name from? The album came, the name of the album comes with, because of course we had to find this out, from a film. It's the 1971 Shuji Terayama directed Japanese film called Tomato Ketchupu Kotai, which is Emperor Tomato Ketchup.
Fantastic. Well, I don't like tomato ketchup.
I
know.
Do.
I know you do. But I never put tomato ketchup on anything. I've never liked it.
Yeah, but you're a bloke. Blokes do HP sauce.
Too many lies. Wake up feeling
family. Sorry. I have to say that, though, because his vibrato in his voice is just so powerful. A song called In My Own Time, first released as a single in 1971 on the Reprise record label. And the B-side was called Seasons, and it reached number 4 in the UK singles charts, and it was in the charts for a total of 13 weeks. A lovely song.
Very unusual. Family were always shocking to me because it's like Burlesque. Yeah, because you listen to Burlesque, which came on the album, which I think was just done after this. I think it was the single in between the two albums. And it was, you know, it's such a and we've played it, haven't we, Burlesque?
Of course. It's a banana to play.
It is, because the interaction between the bass and the guitars and all this, you know, we were talking about this last week. It's really, really unusual. And this, there's some lovely guitar parts in it.
It is beautiful, actually.
It is. And the song is very, you know, it's not rock and roll. It's the first art rock thing, I think, really. British art rock, that's what it was, I think, you know. And the interesting thing is that it was produced by George Chinias. I can't actually remember, or partly produced by him. But he was a staff producer at Olympic, and this was recorded at Olympic Studios. And when you read more about him, this guy is like an unsung hero of all this production at Olympic Studios.
Really?
He was, oh yeah. He was there with Jimi Hendrix. He was there with the Small Faces. He was in the background. And he really, I don't think, got the recognition he deserved.
What's
you know?
His name again? How do you how do you spell it?
Well, right, I'm just going to have to look it up now because I can't actually...
Oh, okay. Oh, I thought you had it up there then.
No, just give me a minute. But anyway.
Okay, this is Olympic Studios.
Yeah.
Well, it was interesting as well with family because when I started reading about what actually happened to them, I feel really bad, you know, and I know that... And it's just his vibrato sometimes gets me. But, you know, they're really unusual. But after a couple of albums and they were really successful in the UK, they went on tour in the USA, right?
Mm.
Guess who their tour manager was?
Go on.
Peter Grant.
No!
Oh, yeah. And do you know what happened? Peter Grant told Rick Gretsch and advised him to leave the band mid-tour and go and join Blind Faith.
Is that right?
Yeah. So basically, it was like damage limitation for the rest of their American tour. And then it goes on that what happens, they were playing at the Fillmore East, Bill Graham, we talked about in the last week's show.
Yeah, of course.
This is really weird how this is all connecting up. So you got Chapman, he was there and he was singing and he lost control of his mic stand. And apparently it went flying towards Bill Graham, and Bill Graham thought it was done on purpose, some aggressive act. So he spent the other performances at the Fillmore with his hands down by his side. And he, just because he was just trying to not lose the gig, so they got so Rick had left, the bass player. So it was just like madness. He lost his voice by the end of the tour and they never recovered in America after that, you know. But what tour manager advises your bass player halfway through to leave?
Well, it was Blind Faith. So it was a supergroup with Steve Winwood and Clapton.
Exactly.
I mean, my goodness, you know.
But this is family.
Mm.
And, you know, what I think my point being is that we know now in retrospect, okay we've got these two big guys, you know, with Blind Faith, absolutely lovely. And I know my brother and ex-brother-in-law, Nick Stevens, you know, he was there in Hyde Park when they played. He's a big Clapton fan. And you know, those are beautiful memories. And you wouldn't want that never to happen. It's not like, you know, you're Doctor Who and you go back and you change things. And you can't change what's happened in the past, you know, and you can't, because it affects time. But I actually think if it was my band, it was like, and your tour manager goes, yeah, Rick, leave. It's another band.
Blimey.
Anyway, carry on. Well, who's this guy that we were talking about?
C-H-K-I-A-N-T-Z. So try and pronounce that. Anyway, that's his name. That's his
second
name.
Right, okay.
So, but it's the end of the show.
Oh, crikey Moses. What we've got, like, literally, like, 35 seconds.
Right, well, what we're going to do is just talk quickly about the last band, Soft Machine.
Yes, and it's Robert Wyatt.
Pigs. In there.
In there.
And shipbuilding, I mean, Robert Wyatt, he was drummer at the time, before he sadly had the accident. Fantastic band, great progressive rock band from, you know, that era,
Cambridge
that 60s.
Era, yeah. Area as well. So there's this whole thing about Cambridge. We'll talk about it more in another show because it's like there's a lot that was going on there, but it's called Hazard Profile Part 1 from their album called Bundles.